to begin to diverge these populations. In the case of Ragulides, there are variation in two traits. One is host preference and avoidance, and this is what Jeff was going to talk about if he was able to make it, where flies emerging from the hawthorn fruit prefer volatiles, prefer odors from the hawthorn, and actually avoid odors from the apple tree. And the flies coming from apples, the apple race, are the opposite. They prefer blends from the apple tree and actually avoid blends, avoid odors from the hawthorn tree. There's also an important difference in the phenology and diapause. Because these flies are really so dependent on their host fruits, they're completely matched with the phenology of the host fruits. And apples tend to fruit about 4 to 6 weeks earlier than hawthorns, so the apple race has shifted its emergence time to emerge 4 to 6 weeks earlier than the hawthorn race. And this gives it to a little allocratic temporal isolation for the maintenance of these two populations. And so when we look at Pomonella in North America, it has a mainly eastern United States distribution, the hawthorn and the apple race. Previous work that I've done in Jeff's lab suggests, and previous work others have done, suggests that the ancestral population came from Mexico, where we have two distinct Mexican populations here, one in the central highlands of Mexico, and then here along the eastern slopes of the Sierra Madre Oriental Mountains. And based on some microsat and mitochondrial DNA work, we found that these two populations of Mexico have been diverging for about 0.8 to 1 million years, corresponding to the eastern uplift of the Mexican transvolcanic region here. And what we've also found is that there's been a recent population expansion from northern Mexico, southern Texas, into the eastern United States, probably or possibly due to after the Pleistocene glacial recession. And what this has resulted in is latitudinal environmental climes in North America. And so here, what we see latitudinal climes versus emergence. So here, what's plotted on the X is latitude from south to north, and here we have the mean number of days to adult occlusion. And you can see here that populations that are collected in the north have a shorter number of days to occlusion, meaning they occlude earlier in the season. This is probably due to the shorter growing periods in the northern latitudes. So early work by Stuart Berlocker and Bruce McFerrin have shown that there are certain allozyme frequencies that are linked to this frequency climb. So here they're showing latitude from south to north, and then certain allozyme frequencies, and you can see as latitude increases, the frequency of certain allozyme alleles increase. These have been mapped to chromosomes 1 through 3. There are 6 chromosomes in Ragulides. Jeff Fader and colleagues found that by sequencing some random cDNAs with Mexican populations as well as North American population, saw evidence of natural selection occurring on cDNAs located on chromosomes 1 through 3 versus chromosomes located in 4 through 5. 6 was relatively untested. These two data suggest that markers on chromosomes 1 through 3 might be under selection, especially for diapause, linking it with the latitudinal climes. So we were interested in looking at the rest of the genome to do a more thorough genetic analysis. So when we first did this, there are 80 microsats available for Pomonella, but we were only able to get 36 to work on this. We're going to try to see if we can get the rest of them one. So I'm presenting data. I would say this is a partial genome scan. We have 7 populations, 4 for hawthorn, here shown in the green, and then 3 for the apple, shown here in the blue. And in 3 collections, we have some patchy collections of both host races. So we're going to look at clinal variation within host races here for the hawthorn, and the clinal variation within the apple. And then in these 3 sites here, we're going to look for any significant genetic allele frequency differentiation between host races. We'll look at allele frequency clines, and then we're also going to use some modern statistical methods to look for deviations from equilibrium, to look for any loci or any loci that are deemed outlier loci, showing more genetic differentiation than is expected, which might link them to selection. So LNRH is a statistic specifically designed for microsatellites. It compares heterozygosity differences between two populations on the suggestion that after selection it decreases heterozygosity after fixation. It's a statistic that's normally distributed, so anything that lies outside 2 standard deviations is deemed significant. FDIS and DETCell use variation in genetic differentiation. And so When we looked at the loci and allele frequencies, our loci broke up into four different categories. First, we had, you can't really see this at the top here, but this is a clinal loci that were just exhibited within the Hall race. So here the Hall race is in the red, and the apple race is in the green. And you can see here a lot of, and I'm not showing all the data, but a lot of loci showing clinal variation in just the Hall race. And what was interesting is that we discovered microsatellite loci on chromosome 4 and 5 also exhibiting significant clinal variation, which is a new result for Pomonella. The other class, we had clinal loci showing in both host races. So here we have, again, the Hawthorne race in red, apple race in green, and we see clinal variation based on allele frequencies in both host races. And again, we see a couple of loci on chromosome 4 showing this difference. Our third category was consistent genetic differentiation between the races. So here we had three loci exhibiting this, and you can see in our Sympatric collections here in Urbana, Dowagiac, Michigan, and Grant, Michigan, we have consistent significant differences in allele frequencies. But interestingly, all these loci map to chromosome 4 and 5. We didn't see any evidence of chromosome 1 through 3. And this might indicate that perhaps odor-specific genes or genes related to the reproductive isolation between these two loci might be located in chromosome 4 and 5. Out of our 36 tested, only three microsatellite loci did not show any differences in allele frequencies either within the races in the Kline or between the host race. And this suggests a greater extent of the genome might be under selection. When we look at more outlier detections and deviations from neutrality, what we see is, first I'll talk about within the host, so here's within the Hawthorne race. We see a lot of loci here showing up as possible indications of recent selection when we compare our southern Texas site. But what's most interesting here is when we compare our most northern sites, where we see P16 consistently showing up as an effect of clinal variation within the Hawthorne race. And here I'm showing the result from FDIST. And what it does is it uses coalescence simulations to estimate the neutral variability, and it does a plot. So here is the average, and it does the negative 95% confidence interval and the positive 95% confidence interval shown here, and it's conditioned on heterozygosity versus FST. So here these black dots represent the FST and heterozygosity of our observed data. Anything over these outliers is deemed a significant effect of selection acting on here. And here, P16 lies just outside this positive 95% confidence interval. So we see not as many loci as we did with the allele frequency clines, but we see P16 consistently showing in the northern populations. We see the same thing in apple populations here, where P16, again, is showing up in our more northern populations. And here is the result of LNRH. Statistic here is the two standard deviations standardized, and then here P16 is high FST and is well outside the two standard deviation ranges. So here again we see P16 evolved in the northern population similar to the Hawthorne. So this might mean P16 could be linked to genes that are responsible for clinal variation and diapause. What's interesting when we compare between host races in our three individual populations, we see again P16 showing up, but it's showing a significant difference only in the Urbana populations here and not in our Dowagiac and Grant populations. So we see that P16 is also, and here is the result from FDIST, and you can see how far apart it is from the 95% confidence interval. So what you can see here is that P16 not only is affecting the clinal variation within races, but at least in our most southern Sympatric collection site, it appears to be differentiated between the two host races. So we see P16 consistently showing up as significant. Why both? Well, it's possible that these could be linked to both diapause and host race genes. And why only Urbana? One thing that I've come up with is that the clines are most different in the south. So the Urbana population represents almost a close to the southern limit of the apple population. So it's possible that these are the area where the host races are most differentiated, and so our power to detect in the outlier selection is greatest here in Urbana. So in conclusion, we see that allele frequency clines exist at many loci, and we see evidence of chromosome 4 and 5, which is a novel result for Pomonella. Previously, it's just thought on chromosomes 1 through 3. We see this conflicting signal from allele frequency clines and the test for neutrality. And I think this is possibly due to our ability to detect differences with these more molecular methods or these more new statistical methods, where because of the recent population expansion, there's a lot of ancestor polymorphism, and just isn't time to sort it out, and the power to detect the outlier loci is weak in these tests, at least for our study here. We see P16 might be a good candidate marker. That's something we are going to investigate further. And what we're going to try to do is look at more markers distributed across the genome, look at the AFLPs. There's been a lot of recent work on AFLPs and outlier detection and looking at loci under selection. We're going to try to combine this with Alzheimer's studies, look at linkages to equilibrium to see if we can pinpoint where in the genome a selection is occurring between the host races. And then we're also going to try to look at differentiation over time. If indeed we see allele frequencies that are more common in the south, which might indicate they're related to warmer temperatures, due to climate change, temperatures in the north are warming up, we might see an increase of more southern alleles in our northern populations. We're going to go back in our freezers and see if we have any collections to see if we can actually document this. And with that, I thank you.
Unfortunately, the next talk is canceled, so we have plenty of time for questions.
Yes, Lisa. So the question was if we saw any differences in the proportion of the presence of those host races in those three populations, and I don't think we do. I think they're equally, that really is dependent on the presence of the hosts. And I think more in the south, I think apples are probably less present, but we can find trees that are infested just as equally in both host races. That is difficult because it's hard to detect hybrids in the field. We have no molecular markers, so it's hard to detect the hybrids. We have been able to cross, and we've been trying to do some crossing studies, and so F1 hybrids in the lab at least seem to be, based on odor detection and odor testing of these F1 hybrids, they seem to be wired differently, so they don't respond to either fruit blend. So at least in the lab, we've documented that there's some post-zygotic isolation there. But in the field, it's very hard to detect hybrids because we collect these off of the host plant, so that's how we define them. And one of the goals of the study was to try to look for molecular markers to detect hybrids, and they just don't exist yet. And so that's something we're going to try in the future.
The project and its heavily web-dependent structure are outlaid in this diagram here. And what I'm going to do is transverse this picture in approximately clockwise fashion, ending up with an overview of the initial results of our molecular study of relationships across the order. Now, a central premise of the project is that an interactive website promoting information exchange and cooperation among Lepidopterists could greatly speed research progress for us and for everybody else. And for almost exactly a year now, since the last meeting, we've had such a site in operation, and we have transported the entire project onto it. New features are being added continually, and it's now possible for any Lepidopterist to post a description of his or her own research and its products. Our own molecular and other results are posted immediately, long before publication, so check us out at leptree.net. Now, one ultimate goal of the website, in turn, is to provide a universally accessible repository of everything that's known about Lepidoptera and phylogeny. And so our informatics gurus have recently placed online a template for entering that information, behind which is a set of incomprehensible web tools which are designed to facilitate exchange with other web projects such as the Arizona Tree of Life Initiative. And we invite anybody who would be interested to contact us about trying out this tool and creating a web page about your favorite Lepidoptera group. Now, our project is not building any morphological data matrices, but we are making good progress toward a product that we hope will greatly facilitate construction of such matrices in the future. Namely, we're getting the experts together in all groups to produce a unified glossary, we hope, of morphological homologies across Lepidoptera, reconciling the current welter of conflicted nomenclature. And this has been going along very nicely. Susan and Amanda hosted a very productive workshop on the female genitalia earlier in this meeting. So we know that to fully understand the evolution of the Lepidoptera, it will be necessary to estimate the ages of the major lineages, and that really has not been done. And to do this, we're going to have to squeeze every last drop of information from the understudied left fossil record. And this week, from Bruce Archibald's talk, I learned that that record is departed because the Lepidoptera are unsinkable. So led by Conrad Lavender and Jay Soane, we're critically reviewing the entire fossil record. We're building a catalog, and we're going to post this online and invite experts in each group to critique the current identification. And just this week, the first sample pages have gone online, and they're going to look like this. Let's see, you're going to see a taxonomic list of all known fossils, and if you click on one of those, you're going to be able to get a comprehensive account of what's known about each individual fossil. And you click on that again, and you'll get an image of what that fossil looks like. And when we get them in the, when we re-photograph these fossils, we are going to send them off to experts to see if they actually can see any synapomorphies in them. Early indications that on that fossil are encouraging. Now, the molecular backbone phylogeny, which is going to be one of our central projects, draws on our collection of alcohol-preserved materials, which we intend as a permanent world resource. And at present, the holdings are something over 10,000 specimens, 1,800 genera, contributed by more than 100 collectors, to all of whom we are very grateful. And in turn, our project has already provided material to a dozen other phylogenetic projects around the world. It's also the case that over the past year, we have developed a very useful, fruitful collaboration with the Lepidoptera Barcode of Life project. We've sent them some 1,200 specimens. They have provided confirmation of IRDs in most cases, and a few cases concerning authorities that I'm too polite to name, well, they actually found a few mistakes that we made. And in return, I think our material has been useful to some of their projects, and it's led to discussions about the possibility that maybe Tree of Life and Barcode of Life could eventually combine forces. If maybe you put those two data sets together, you might be able to get something approaching a species-level phylogeny. Sure, for all the Lepidoptera. Our own molecular sequencing has been progressing rapidly. We've now got completed or in process sequencing for about 400 species, representing most of the families. And for about half of those species, we've done our basic set of five especially well-tested genes, totaling about 6.7 kb. And for the other half of those, we've now sequenced 19 to 26 genes, so 15 to 19 kb. And we have posted our results over the past couple of months. And we're going to publish those jointly with the many people who has helped and guidance have made those studies possible. And those first results come from a set of pilot studies. The first thing we undertook was to solve the following problem. Somehow you managed to argue for the money, even though you had this no idea as what would be the optimal strategy of gene versus taxon sampling to maximize the number of strongly resolved nodes you could get before your money ran out. So we did some experiments with different ratios of gene to taxon sampling in different parts of the tree to try to get some idea of this. And I'm going to finish with a result of one such experiment. And it's the one we intend to publish first as soon as we figure out how to actually write a paper with 21 authors. And so this study tested the ability of our favorite five genes to resolve relationships in the very large putative clade Optectomera, which consists of the so-called Macrolepidoptera and their nearest relatives. The total number of taxa is 123, and these included a substantial number of more primitive Lepidopterans as outgroups. Our analytical approach has been maximum likelihood using the program Valley. And the tree I'm going to show you is big enough that I'll break it into two parts and tell you a message in case you can't read it. Here's the top half of the tree. And I'd summarize by saying that the overall degree of resolution is as follows. Most families and superfamilies previously recognized were recovered, but with quite variable degrees of bootstrap support. We did find very gratifyingly strong resolution within superfamilies, including the number which had not been previously studied, things like pyraloids, geometroids, noctuids, corticoids, and so on. But there is very little strong resolution among superfamilies. It clearly is going to take a lot more than five genes to strongly resolve those deep branches. And on the other hand, close inspection shows that there really is already a lot of information about deep divergences in these data. So on a broad scale, the positions of most families correspond approximately to where they lie in the working hypothesis laid out in the Christensen Bible, which our project seeks to test. And it was very reassuring to me this week to talk to Lauri Kaila from Finland and discover that where our trees depart from previous groupings, exactly the same departures are seen without exception in the parallel molecular analysis that they're doing on a similar scale. So we decided to see whether the current data has the power to statistically reject some of those previous groupings, even though there's not strong support for individual nodes. So here are the results of some of those tests, and now you can see that in a number of cases we are able to, our data are able to significantly reject the notion that the clade as previously defined was monophyletic. And in fact, the troublemakers in many of these cases seems to be the butterflies, and so I'll finish by telling what they did. Butterflies